by the end of the quarter. So we studied half of it the first quarter, and now my plan is to study the second half of the second quarter. Coming up, we're going to have Wednesday night will be singing night, so we will not have that class. Next Sunday, I will be gone in a meeting. In fact, I'm going to be in meetings the rest of June. And so next Sunday, there will be a class, and then a Wednesday night, which I will not teach. The next week will be our meeting, and Brother Adams is going to preach during the Sunday morning class. And, of course, we'll have the service Wednesday night instead of a class. And so then the next Sunday, we'll have a class, and then a Wednesday night. So I'm going to miss the next four classes. So I'm going to get some to substitute for me during that time. And I'm sorry to miss, but that's just the way the schedule breaks. So let's look now at chapter 12, Revelation. And remember that what I've been telling you is that in the first 11 chapters, we've been seeing the saints of God involved in the struggle. A struggle that ensued because of the going forth of Jesus, the work that He did, the life that He lived, the death He died, His resurrection. And then His going forth, ascending back to heaven, the work begins. The saints suffer. The saints are involved in struggle. God is giving different views of time in here in these first chapters, in these first 11 chapters. But then in chapter 12, God begins to show us a deeper insight into what is going on in the book of Revelation. And to me, it is as if He does draw that curtain back that I've been sort of doing, demonstrating, illustrating the idea. He's going to show us the real combatants in this struggle that we are involved in, but we're not the main ones. And so that's what we're going to see now as this begins here. So chapter 12, a great sign was seen in heaven. You see a woman arrayed with the sun. Now it takes a minute to let that register. She is arrayed with the sun. So in some ways that she is dressed with the sun. The moon is under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. So here is a woman who in all of her attire and so on has the sun, the moon, and the stars. What does that mean? I venture this idea. I think that possibly it does refer to the totality of revelation of God, the fullness of the mystery, everything. This, in other words, the great plan of God is coming to pass fully and completely. And what we're seeing revealed here in chapter 12, we're seeing the fullness of the revelation of God breaking. Who is this woman? Well, let's go back to a few passages in the Old Testament. One of them is Micah 4. I think that Micah 4 is a really, really good passage on this point. Because as you go ahead reading in Revelation 12 about this woman, you will find that one thing that is done is that after a point she flees into the wilderness where she has a place prepared of God that there they may nourish her. So she goes into the wilderness. All right, in Micah 4 and verse, let's begin in verse 9. In fact, let's look at a thing or two like verse 8. He refers to the daughter of Zion. And verse 9, now why dost thou cry out aloud? This is Micah 4 and verse 9. Now why dost thou cry out aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished? That pangs have taken hold of thee as a woman, as of a woman in travail? So here is the idea of concern. Concern about the future. Concern about what's going to be the outcome of things. And in verse 10, he addresses, O daughter of Zion, be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and shalt dwell in the field, and shall come even unto Babylon, There shalt thou be rescued. There will the Lord redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. So I think that Micah is giving us some good insight into this woman. And Micah refers to this woman as the daughter of Zion. Another passage in Isaiah 66, verse 7. Before she travailed, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a man-child. Who hath heard such a thing? Who hath seen such things? Shall a land be born in one day? Shall a nation be brought forth at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth, saith the Lord? Shall I that cause to bring forth shut the womb, saith thy God? Now the context in chapter 66 of Isaiah is where God is making restoration promises having to do with the future of His people. Now, I know that all of you know that, right? We're having people coming in, and that is really good. I'm glad to have all of you here. But now then, are you with me? All right, you remember in the Old Testament what happened to Judah because of her wickedness? She was taken away into captivity. Who took her away? Babylon. Now then, in Isaiah, God is making promises about what's going to happen to Judah when that day occurs. But do you remember that the point we've made so often before is that in the days of Isaiah, Babylon had not yet become a world empire. Babylon itself was barely visible on world history radar at this point. And yet here Isaiah is prophesying things that are going, he's prophesying assurance for the people of God who are going to be carried away into captivity, and he's promising that they're going to be brought back. There is a future. There is a future for the people of God. Now it was a little hard for them to believe that. And so he uses this imagery then, like here is a woman that she is expecting a child. And so there's going to be the normal great, here's the difficulty having the baby. Except, no, what happens? What happens? Before she travailed, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a man-child. So that the point is, God is going to bless Judah. He is going to do what He promised to do. He is going to restore Judah, and so on. Now, can you see that much? You can understand that much now, right? I mean, we don't need to go any deeper than that. But you can see that that's the point that He's making. All right, now there's another thing we've got to do here. When He talks about Zion or the daughter of Zion, He is not talking about anybody who, for example, wore the name of an Israelite. Because as Paul said in Romans 9, 10, and 11, he said, they are not all Israel that are called Israel. So this daughter of Zion refers to the true people of God who from the very beginning have sought God and have relied upon Him, who have believed in Him and trusted in Him and in His ways, who have depended upon Him. Their hopes are in Him. Just like a woman that's going to have a child is hoping that the child is going to be okay and that the child will be born all right. And so here are the people who have believed in God, they've trusted in God, and they have depended upon God. It is in connection with their hopes and their faith, it is in connection with their dependence upon God that Jesus is born. He is born because He was promised by God. He was promised by God to whom? To mankind, but particularly to those who would recognize their need. You remember where the first promise was? We know that, don't we? Genesis 3:15. Yes. I will put enmity between you and the woman. Oh, and by the way, don't you think that's a pretty good one also to put into the pot here in this story? I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. He will bruise your head, you will bruise his heel. That was the promise of God. And throughout all the Old Testament, this promise is on its way to being fulfilled. And so as we go back now and look at this woman is not Mary. Mary doesn't fit the picture at all. It's not Jews, because the Jews, as the Jews, remember what they did with Jesus? They rejected Jesus. He came unto His own, and His own received Him not. John 1 and verse 11. So no, this is not Mary. No, this is not the Jews. Neither is it Christians. Because the Christians did not bring forth Jesus. The church did not bring forth Jesus. So I believe that what this woman is she is a representative of the true people of God, for whom God has had His purposes and so on. Those who have believed in Him, hoped in Him, and depended upon Him. I think that's most likely the best explanation here. And so here she is, arrayed with the sun, the moon under her feet, upon her head a crown of 12 stars. She's with child. She cried out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered. So keep in mind the passages that we've referred to in Micah, especially Micah 4 and verse 10. All right, so now that's one part of it. And remember, it would be like you're looking up, you know, and up there, all right, here you see this woman dressed in the sun, the moon under her feet, and a crown with 12 stars. And you're looking at that. Oh, there's another thing, a most fearsome thing to behold. There was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon. Now, whatever this dragon looked like, I kind of get the idea it was scary. You wouldn't have looked at this dragon and said, well, what a little kitty cat that is. Right? If you had seen this dragon, you would have been filled with fear at such a powerful thing. Behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his heads 7 diadems. In the book of Revelation, we read of 2 different words that are used for a crown or a diadem. One is the diadem, and in the original, that's pretty well what the Greek word is. It's pretty close to that. And then the other one that is sometimes just rendered crown, it is Stephanos. And Stephanos means a victory crown. Now, here's the interesting thing. Though in the book of Revelation, the devil is referred to as wearing diadems, which was a sign of power and royalty, he is never shown, he is never described as wearing the Stephanos, because that was a crown of victory. So he's never shown as wearing the Stephanos, the crown of victory. You know why? Because the devil doesn't win. So I think that's a very interesting point that is made in the book. Here, he is wearing these 7 diadems. I believe the simple point being made here is that here is a most powerful being filled with intelligence and power to do. He is a fearsome being. This is not a being to discount. And his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven. Now, I'm not too interested in trying to decide what the stars of heaven are there. If you want to, that'd be okay. To me, it is simply that when you see this vision, you see this woman over here, then you see this dragon over here, and he just lashes that old tail, and a third of the stars fall out of the heavens. It would be sufficient to say that what that's doing is showing us, just adding to the picture of the power of this being. That would be sufficient. If we want to say what they are, well, field's kind of wide open. Sometimes the idea of the stars are used to refer to world leaders, leadership. I don't really see that here. I'm not sure what it is. I think that we're content just to say that here these stars are swept down, a third of the stars swept down by this dragon. Oh, how powerful he is. And it casts them down to the earth. Some suggest that it may represent that even some of the children of God. Some say it might even be the angels that kept not their proper habitation. That Peter tells us about in 2 Peter 2, and that Jude tells us about in the book of Jude. And we're going to look at those verses a little more closely. It could be that. I don't have any problem with that. It's just that I have a little difficulty proving that that's what it is. So I say to you again that when we are dealing with a symbol, if God helps us with that symbol by saying the seven stars, which are the angels of the seven churches, okay, then that's good. We know what that is. But if He doesn't tell us what it is, then we have another recourse to see if we can find a prophetic usage of that symbol in the Old Testament, like we did there with Micah and the woman, that will help us to identify. If we can't do that, then I think that we need to be very cautious about identifying it. So it could be some of these other things that I've mentioned, but it is sufficient to let it just be a part of the picture of the power of this being here. All right, He is standing before the woman that is about to be delivered. Can you just picture the intensity of this situation? Does this woman want her baby snapped up and swallowed by this dragon the moment the child is born? Would that be what any woman would want, to see her child that's just born gobbled up by some horrible animal? Well, no. What's going to keep it from happening? Looks hopeless, doesn't it? Sort of like when Jesus was crucified. But when He was crucified, was it hopeless? No. It was not hopeless. And we're going to see why it was not hopeless. She was delivered of a son, a man-child. Who is this man-child? Look at the prophetic clue here. She was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Now, you can look it up in your reference, or you can remember. What is that a reference to? Huh? All right. It's the Messiah. What is the passage? Psalm 2. That's right. Psalm 2. You will rule them with a rod of iron. So here, John and the Holy Spirit, inspiring John, has him to use this expression from Psalm 2 and verse 9, "Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron." And we read about that rod of iron in the Old Testament, like Isaiah 11:4. And here we see that rod of iron. Psalm 2 is definitely, most powerfully, a messianic passage having to do with the establishment of the kingdom of the Messiah, the kingdom that God is going to set up for His Son, and so on. So clearly, this is Jesus. This is the Messiah, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, having to do with His power and authority to rule. So why is her child not eaten up, meaning totally devastated and done away with by the devil, by this great red dragon? Why is that? Why does it not happen? He was caught up unto God and unto His throne. So now watch what the dragon is doing. The dragon is just, he's just here, just waiting, just waiting, just waiting. That child is born. He's going to grab the child and he's going to devour the child, and that will take care of the child. And so what happens? He fails, right? See that? He fails. He does not succeed. Why? Because God snatches the child up. Now that's the figure here. And of course the literal is that Jesus died on the cross with the devil thinking that He had won, because He moved the people of the day, both Jews and Gentiles, Jews and Romans, to act against Jesus, to crucify Him. And yet, as I like to quote Peter on the day of Pentecost, he says, "It was not possible that he should be holden of it." Do you remember that statement that Peter made there in that sermon on the day of Pentecost when he talked about he descended into Hades? In other words, he died, but it was not possible that he should be holden of it. God raised him from the dead, and then he ascended into heaven. So that God has now taken the Messiah. So, see, now look at it. This means the dragon is not going to be able to put a stop to all of this by destroying the Christ. So now, you know, if you didn't even know what the rest of this said, and you know that the dragon made his very best try he could at devouring the man-child, and he failed, what would you guess he might then turn against? The woman. That's right. And the woman fled into the wilderness. All right, now that goes back to the passage, especially in Micah 4 and verse 10, signifying the idea of the protection of God. The protection of God, that He will not allow Satan to destroy the, as you might say here, the corporate body of His people. He will not allow the devil to destroy the church. By this time, that's what it is. Now, the woman has been the people of God, but by now, this woman is representing still the true people of God, the true saints of God, those that hope in God and believe in God and depend upon God. But this is now the church that Jesus established. And so Satan is saying, okay, I could not destroy the Messiah. What will I do? I will destroy the church. And when the hammer of persecution came against the church in Jerusalem, it began very quickly. When Peter and John healed the lame man in chapter 3, and then the Sadducees arrested them because they were preaching the resurrection, and the persecution grew in its intensity until the stoning of Stephen in Acts 7. And in Acts 8:4, what does the Bible tell us about the disciples that were there in Jerusalem? Scattered abroad, went everywhere preaching the word. So the devil tries, I'm going to just stomp this church out. I'm going after this woman. No, you're not going to be able to kill the woman. And so she flees into the wilderness where she has a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days, which is the same period as the 42 months, the time, times, and half a time that we've been looking at before, which just symbolizes this period of intense persecution, such as the people were in at this time. And so here is the woman. She is protected by God. It doesn't mean now you've got to distinguish between individual saints and the woman. Individual saints may be killed, but that's not the woman being killed. The woman is a reference to all the people of God. And so God protects her and will not allow her to be destroyed. I think that might be involved. Definitely, though, in other words, that may be a part of it. Because it is true that in times when the church is undergoing persecution, there was most definitely austerity involved. I don't know if that's particularly symbolized by the use of wilderness or whether wilderness is just talking about a remote place, you know, protected. It may, though. And that's a good thought. Because it is certainly true, both in the Old Testament and in the New, that when you look at those times of persecution and you look at what the people of God and the saints had to do to avoid that persecution, a lot of times it was a very austere thing that they were submitted to. So that might very well be a possibility there. All right, so in those first six verses, yes, I wanted to ask, any comments? It's not specified, so I don't know. I would suppose it is the servants of God that he uses, otherwise undifferentiated. What do you think? Yeah. I don't know. I don't see a distinct connection there, but it might be. Right. Yes, that's right. And let me say one more thing, and I may have already forgotten it. Would you state your point again, Buford? Yeah. All right, because these two witnesses were protected, weren't they? And that's the point you're making. All right, that's really good. I thought that might be it, and I wanted to be sure I did not leave that hanging. Yes, remember the two witnesses that we looked at in chapter 11? Remember that we made the point how they were protected by God until they gave their testimony. Yeah, and finished their prophesy. That's a good point. So there is a similarity there between them and the fact that the woman here is being preserved. And then, Chuck, your point also, I think, is a very good point, that in the wilderness, when the children of Israel were there, they were nourished by God. By what? By the manna. And so God gave them both their food and their drink. He took care of them. So I think that's good points. Anyone else have another point to make on the first six verses? No, I don't know either. And so all I can say is that the servants of God, God Himself, whoever might be involved. Yeah. When it says, where she hath a place prepared of God, singular, that there they, the only way they could be referring to God there would be if it were breaking it down into the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. I rather think that I'd have a hard time saying I can really prove that. I would rather think that it is perhaps more general that God uses angels and whatever else. Yes, Jerry? I think that's a good point, and I think that as we look particularly at the passage, say, taking up in verse 13, where it's talking about the children of the woman, especially there, I think we have the idea of spiritual protection. But yes, we also have to assign spiritual protection back here, because it is not merely a matter of physical sustenance here. This is not the primary thing. I do think that the idea that even though persecution was attempted on a pretty wide scale there in Jerusalem, it failed. Physical persecution, it failed. So, to what extent spiritual attack is involved here in the woman, on the woman, to what extent that's true, I'm not sure. Probably it is. I know it is involved, as he goes on in verses 13 and talking about let me read in verse 17, the very last verse of the chapter. And the dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed that keep the commandment of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So we've got three, you might say, parties of attack here. The first one is the man-child. So the first effort of the devil is to destroy the man-child. The second target is the woman. And the devil seeks to destroy the woman. He utterly fails. The third target of the devil is the seed of the woman. In other words, these are, I think, the individual Christians. Having failed to destroy the body, now he goes after the saints. The individuals. And to the devil, it really doesn't matter to him. Of course, I'm sure he would have rather just succeeded in destroying the man-child and then it would have all been over. Or the woman, but he's just as willing to go ahead and If he brings you down, then he has succeeded with you. Or if he brings me down, he succeeded with me. And so we've got to remember that the devil hasn't given up, and he does not give up. And so remember now, don't get carried away by the things that we say, well, I don't know what that means. Well, I don't know what that means. Look at the message. Look at the picture. The picture is that the devil has made an all-out effort to destroy what God is doing, and he has failed. So let's keep on that track. Now in verse 7, we have one of the passages which I'm sure John Milton really relied heavily on this passage, and some others, in writing Paradise Lost. And there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon, and the dragon warred and his angels. So what you have to deal with is today we live in a climate where what people want to do is they want to take this verse and they want to lift it out of its context, take it all the way back to some primeval time in the past, and show that this is a description of the actual process that is involved in the statements that Peter makes in 2 Peter 2 and Jude makes in his small epistle about the angels that sin and kept not their proper habitation and so on. The thing is, in this context, that's not where this fits. That doesn't fit the context. Let's go back and look at those two passages just briefly in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. For if God spared not angels when they sinned, but cast them down to hell, and the word in the original there is Tartarus, not the normal word for hell, which is Gehenna, and committed them to pits of darkness, and some authorities, some manuscripts read chains of darkness, to be reserved unto judgment. So the thing to really lock on to in that, God spared not angels when they sinned. They are reserved unto judgment. So this tells us there were angels that sinned, and they are reserved unto judgment. And then Jude, in Jude verse 6, and angels that kept not their own principality, but left their proper habitation, he hath kept in everlasting bonds under darkness. Kept not their own principality, left their proper habitation. I think gives us the only key that we've got to what these angels actually did. It was a matter of authority. It was a matter of power. It was a matter of not keeping their own principality. They left their proper habitation. In other words, it was a matter of their not remaining in the role that they had been created for. And therefore, it was a matter of authority and a rebellion against authority and so on. But the Bible does not give us any historical account of that taking place. And this passage is not a historical account of that taking place. And what we have to do, look at this. Look at the description here. Michael is identified as the archangel in the book of Jude. He identifies him as Michael the archangel. And so we may presume he's the archangel that's referred to in 1 Thessalonians 4, even though the archangel there is not named. I confess unto you, I don't know for sure how many archangels there are. I know there's one that's named, Michael. I don't know any others that are named, but I don't know whether he's the only one. So see, stuff like that, we just don't know. Therefore, there's no need for us to really get all bound up in that. But Michael is here acting as the leader. He is here definitely acting as the archangel that he is described as in the book of Jude. There was war in heaven, Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon, and the dragon warred and his angels. And they prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast down. Now here's where we find out for sure who this dragon is. The old serpent, meaning the ancient serpent. See, there's a clue. This is the serpent in the garden. He that is called the devil, Diabolos. Diabolos, the devil, slanderer, accuser. And Satan, meaning adversary, enemy, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. Okay, and so what then? And I heard a great voice in heaven saying, now is come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of His Christ. Now, according to verse 10, and that word now, when would this be placing this story? Because now that this has happened, what? Yes. In other words, when Jesus, the passages are so full. Remember Hebrews 2:14? Since then the children are sharers in flesh and blood, He also Himself, referring to Christ, He also Himself in like manner partook of the same, that He might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all them who through all their lifetime were subject unto bondage. Jesus, in dying, destroyed the devil. In other words, the devil was defeated. And the mention of Michael and his angels here is symbolic language being used, not to say that until Jesus died on the cross. This is not saying that at the beginning of the world sometime back there, Michael and his angels did this. No, this is in connection with what has been described. This man-child being born, and instead of being destroyed, he goes back to heaven, and by his having succeeded and so on, the devil is brought down. He is defeated. He brought to naught him that had the power of death. Now that passage in Hebrews 2:14, of course, applied there to the time when Jesus was upon the work and the work that He did while He was upon the earth and so on. And yet the devil was already the devil. And the demons were already the demons. So the angels that sinned and kept not their proper habitation, that had already happened. That had already happened. So this is symbolic language. And one thing you have to understand. Now, one of the statements that Milton makes, he says something like this. He said, no one could know how powerful God is without knowing how powerful the devil is. He makes some statement like that. And while I think it is good for us to not to underestimate the devil, on the other hand, we have to realize, you know how hard it would be for God to deal with the devil? If God wanted to just say, okay, your history, what would He have to do? It'd be the equivalent of the snap of our fingers. So let us not get the idea here that, wow, boy, that was hard. Well, it was hard because of what had to be done to do it, but it wasn't hard because God didn't have the power. Right? In other words, how did Jesus destroy the devil? How did God choose that that be done? Through a very, very difficult thing that Jesus came to the earth to do. Many reasons being served by that way of doing it. But nevertheless, though it involved a tremendous sacrifice on the part of God and a tremendous sacrifice on the part of the devil, it did not mean that God, He just barely managed to defeat the devil. Yes, Travis. Yes. Yes. Quote it. Yes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's right. No, he didn't. That's right. That's right. That's right. So he was outsmarted, wasn't he? Yes. And so the point is that I don't want you, as we fully appreciate the power and the craftiness of the devil, let us not for one moment get the idea that the outcome was ever in any doubt. We must not think that. The outcome was never in doubt for even a moment. Okay, so our time is about up today, but be sure and note in verse 9 the terms there, the old serpent, the ancient serpent. This is used more than once in Revelation to identify the devil with the tempter back there in the garden. In fact, this is one of the passages that helps us to know that the serpent back there in the garden was the devil. He was doing the work of the devil, we know, back there. But here, the devil is referred to as that old serpent, the ancient serpent. Okay, so we'll take up there about verse 10.